Hello, it's great to be with you. I started to say good morning, but that's over. So good afternoon. It's good to be here with you. And in thinking about this event, I've been reading through some material related to the Benedictine Order of Monks, something that every Baptist seminary president needs to do on a regular basis, I guess. But let me tell you, there's something in the monastic ideal that's really important, and something that's been lost to us, and that is just imagine that what these monks did, and now somewhere do, that for centuries, they began every single day by gathering together for prayer, and in the commonality of brothers, they got together to say, and this is really what they were doing in the morning, this is who we are, this is whose we are, this is why we're here, this is what we're going to do. And then at the end of the day, they got together again and said, let's remember, this is who we are, this is whose we are, this is why we're here, this is what we're going to do. And there's a regularity in that, a discipline in that, that is altogether missing from so much of contemporary evangelical life. I mean, we're just kind of free agents out there. And that's why this kind of conversation is really important, because Christian men need to get together. Now, I'm not calling us all to be monks. That would kind of violate my discussion about pornography's effect on marriage. But there is something to the seriousness of Christian men getting together on a regular basis and saying, let's remember who we are, let's remember whose we are, let's remember why we're here, let's remember what we're supposed to do. And that's a good thing. And if we don't do it every morning and every night, then we ought to do it with more regularity than we do, and let's admit that to each other. And so this is an altogether good thing. And I'm honored to have a part. I appreciate the presentations that I know have already been made by Pastor Fullerton and Dr. Cottrell. And I did not choose the particular terrain of my conversation with you here today. It was an assignment, but it's a glad assignment. And I am glad that I had this particular part. I am involved, and I had the man-to-man discussion with the guys last semester. And I've had other conversations over the last several years in this big project I'm working on an evangelical theology of sexuality and marriage and holiness, and what that would require, gender, embodiment, issues that I think evangelicals haven't talked about enough. And so what I want to do today is to direct a specifically theological view at the question of pornography and at the issue of marriage, and then I want to leave time for conversation with each of you and with the group through questions. Now, Jonathan has two packages of Post-it notes. These are to be the same as index cards we've used before. They're just sticky paper for sticky questions. So use the opportunity to ask whatever question. You can write it down. Sometimes that's easier than asking it by standing up. So just feel free to write down whatever question may come to you. These will be collected at the end, and we'll try to go through as many as possible. This is an important day to talk about important things, and we want to be good stewards in this time together. Now, I'm going to speak to you in the kind of directness that you may find a little disconcerting. But here again, I think we need to take our cue from the directness of biblical revelation and from the directness of the best kind of conversations about things that matter, especially to the Christian man. In Job chapter 31, verse 1, we read Job saying, I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? Now, obviously, Job is not here asking the question as to how he might see her with the ocular organ of the eye. That is not the issue. He is concerned with looking at a virgin in a way Job has no right to look. And that really runs against the strain of our entire culture, which is a looking culture, a leering culture, a lusting culture. And the very idea that there are certain things we ought not to see that might be pleasant to the eye, that might be fertile for sexual fantasies, that would be forbidden in any way, that runs so much against the postmodern mind and against the mentality of a sex-crazed society. But we have this here from the Word of God as an example that's not only found in some kind of isolated text in the book of Job and the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, but is rather affirmed throughout the Bible, from Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount all the way to the Apostle Paul's warnings to Timothy to flee youthful lusts, all the way back to where we know the problem of lust began in Genesis chapter 3 when sin entered human experience. The intersection of pornography and marriage is one of the most problematic issues facing many couples today, including many Christian couples. The pervasive plague of pornography represents one of the greatest moral challenges faced by the Christian church in the postmodern age. With eroticism woven into the very heart of the culture, celebrated in its entertainment and advertised as a commodity, it is virtually impossible to escape the pervasive influence of pornography in our culture and in our lives. At the same time, the problem of human sinfulness is fundamentally unchanged from the time of the fall until the present. There's no theological basis for assuming that human beings are more lustful or are more defenseless before sexual temptation or more susceptible to the corruption of sexual desire than was the case in any previous generation. This is one of the frustrations I face, is that many Christians act like this is a new thing. You know, this lust problem, boy, it sure must have been great to have lived in the 14th century when that wasn't a problem. You know, or that our fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers didn't have to struggle with the same thing. Let's not fool ourselves. It is an old problem. It is a persistent sin. But there is a distinction about our time. It's not a distinction in terms of the sexual temptation, but rather the environment. Two distinctions mark the present age from previous eras. First, pornography has become so mainstreamed through advertising, commercial images, entertainment, and everyday life that what would have been illegal just a few decades ago is now taken as common dress, common entertainment, and unremarkable sensuality. Second, explicit eroticism, complete with pornographic images, narrative, and symbolism, is now celebrated as a cultural good in some sectors of our society. Pornography, now reported to be the seventh largest business in America, claims its own icons and public figures, that is to say, its own celebrities. Hugh Hefner, the founder of Playboy, is considered by many Americans to be a model of entrepreneurial success, sexual pleasure, and a liberated lifestyle. The use of Hugh Hefner as a spokesman by a family-based hamburger chain in California indicates something of how pornography itself has been mainstreamed in the culture. Growing out of these two developments is a third reality, namely that increased exposure to erotic stimulation creates the need for ever-increased stimulation in order to demand notice, arouse sexual interest, and retain attention. In an odd twist, hyper-exposure to pornography leads to a lower net return on investment, which is to say that the more pornography one sees, the more explicit the images must be in order to excite interest. As the postmodernist would explain, in order to transgress, pornographers must continue to press the envelope. One further qualification must be added to this picture. Pornography is mainly, though not exclusively, a male phenomenon. That is to say, the users and consumers of pornography are overwhelmingly male, boys and men. In the name of women's liberation, some pornography directed towards a female market has emerged in recent years. Nevertheless, this is decidedly a niche market in the larger pornographic economy. The fact remains that many men pay a great deal of money and spend a great deal of time looking for and looking at pornographic images in order to arouse themselves sexually. Well, what's going on here? Why is pornography such a big business? The answer to that question lies in two fundamental realities. First, the most fundamental answer to the question must be rooted in a biblical understanding of human beings as sinners. We must take into full account the fact that sin has corrupted every good thing in creation, and the effects of sin extend to every dimension of life. The sex drive, which should point us toward covenant fidelity in marriage and all the goods associated with that most basic institution, has instead been corrupted to devastating effects. Rather than directed towards fidelity, covenantal commitment, procreation, and the wonder of the one-flesh relationship, the sex drive has been degraded into a passion that robs God of His glory, celebrating the sensual at the expense of the spiritual and setting what God had intended for good on a path that leads to destruction in the name of personal fulfillment. The most important answer we can give to pornography's rise in popularity is rooted in the Christian doctrine of sin. As sinners, we corrupt what God has perfectly designed for the good of His creatures, and we have turned sex into a carnival of orgiastic pleasures. Not only have we severed sex from marriage, but as a society, we now look at marriage as an imposition, chastity as an embarrassment, and sexual restraint as a psychological hang-up. The doctrine of sin explains why we have exchanged the glory of God for Sigmund Freud's concept of polymorphous perversity. In addition to this, we must recognize that a capitalist free market economy rewards those who produce a product that is both attractive and appetitive. The purveyors of pornography know that they succeed by directing their product to the lowest common denominator of humanity, a depraved sexual mind. Without the legal restraints common in previous generations, pornographers are now free to sell their goods virtually without restriction. Beyond this, they base their marketing plan on the assumption that an individual can be seduced into the use of pornography and then will be hooked into a pattern of dependence upon pornographic images and the need for ever more explicit sexual material as a means toward sexual arousal. The bottom line is that in our sinfulness, men are drawn toward pornography, and a frighteningly large percentage of men develop a dependence upon pornographic images for their own sexual arousal and for their concept of the good life, sexual fulfillment, and even meaning in life. Medical research can document the increased flow of endorphins, that is, hormones that create pleasure in the brain, when sexual images are viewed. Given the law of reduced effect, greater stimulation is needed to keep a constant flow of endorphins to the brain's pleasure centers. Without conscious awareness of what is happening, men are drawn into a pattern of deeper and deeper sin, more and more explicit pornography, and never-ending rationalizing. And all this started when the eye first began its perusal of the pornographic image and sexual arousal was its product. The postmodern age has brought many wonders as well as incredible moral challenges. Often, technological achievement and moral complexity come hand in hand. This is most explicitly the case with the development of the Internet. For the first time in human history, a teenager in his bedroom has access to an innumerable array of pornographic websites catering to every imaginable sexual passion, perversion, and pleasure. Today's teenager, if not stranded on some desert island without electricity, is likely to know more about sex and its complexities than his father knew when he got married. Furthermore, what most generations have known only in the imagination, if at all, is now there for the viewing on websites, both commercial and free. The Internet has brought an interstate highway of pornography into every community with exit ramps at every terminal or personal computer. Specifically, what about pornography in marriage? The Christian worldview must direct all considerations of sexuality to the institution of marriage. Let me just nail that down. If there's only one thing we have to make clear about the Christian worldview in sex, is that we cannot speak about sex without speaking about marriage. If ever we allow sex to be divorced from the frame of marriage, we will inevitably be led in an unbiblical direction. So let's just get that down. Marriage is not merely the arena for sexual activity. It is presented in Scripture as the divinely designed arena for the display of God's glory on earth, as a man and a wife come together in a one-flesh relationship within the marriage covenant. Rightly understood and rightly ordered, marriage is a picture of God's own covenantal faithfulness. Marriage is to display God's glory, reveal God's good gifts to His creatures, and protect human beings from the inevitable disaster that follows when sexual passions are divorced from their rightful place. The marginalization of marriage and the open antipathy with which many in the cultural elite approach the question of marriage produces a context in which Christians committed to a marriage ethic appear hopelessly out of step with the larger culture. Whereas marriage is seen as a privatized contract to be made and unmade and remade at will in the larger society, Christians must see marriage as an inviolable covenant made before God, that is, before God and man, that establishes both temporal and eternal realities. That's another important point. We need to speak about marriage not just in terms of its temporal significance, but also in terms of its eternal significance, as the Scripture makes clear that we as husbands are to live in such a way and to minister and to lead in such a way that we can actually present our wives unto Christ, even as Christ Himself receives His bride in the church. Christians have no right to be embarrassed when it comes to talking about sex and sexuality. An unhealthy reticence or embarrassment in dealing with these issues is a form of disrespect to God's creation. Whatever God made is good. And every good thing God has made, He made for an intended purpose that ultimately reveals His own glory. When conservative Christians respond to sex with ambivalence or embarrassment, we slander the goodness of God. And we hide God's glory, which is intended to be revealed in the right use of creation's gifts. Therefore, our first responsibility is to point all persons toward the right use of God's good gifts and the legitimacy of sex in marriage as one vital aspect of God's intention in marriage from the very beginning. That said, pornography represents one of the most insidious attacks on the sanctity of marriage and the goodness of sex within the one-flesh relationship. The celebration of debauchery rather than purity, the elevation of genital pleasure over all other considerations, and the corruption of sexual energy through an inversion of the self corrupts the idea of marriage, leads to incalculable harm, and subverts marriage and the marital bond. Now, what about the realities of marital sex? This is very much a part of what we have to take into consideration when we talk about pornography's effect on marriage. Because we know up front, and I think it will be a common matter of conversation among Christian men to say that pornography has many ill effects upon marriage, both before marriage and in marriage. But why? Many individuals, especially young men, hold a false expectation of what sex represents within the marriage relationship. Since the male sex drive is largely directed towards genital pleasure, men often assume that women are just the same. While physical pleasure is certainly a part of the female experience of sex, it is not as focused on the solitary goal of genital fulfillment as is the case with many men. A biblical worldview understands that God has demonstrated His glory in both the sameness and the differences that mark men and women, male and female. Alike made in the image of God, men and women are literally made for each other. The physicality of the male and the female bodies cries out for the fulfillment of the other. The sex drive calls both men and women out of themselves and toward a covenantal relationship which is consummated in a one-flesh union. This is one of the issues I try to talk about when I speak to Christian men on this issue. What in the world is the sex drive doing? God put that in us for some good reason, for His good pleasure. I hear far too many conservative Christians talk about the sex drive as if it is a burden, as if it is some awful thing that is within us. But if God put it there, it can't be awful. It had some purpose. Now, Augustine in the 4th century tried to deal with this by saying that the drive towards genital pleasure is itself just sin. The problem with that is that that's inconsistent with the biblical revelation. So if it's not sin, what is it? I believe that God uses the sex drive to call men to be men and to do what men must do in order to be married, to provide leadership, and to find the love and accountability that comes in the marital bond. Now, what do I mean by that? We're just talking among ourselves here. Men are more naturally directed towards apathy. That's evidence of sin. And towards sloth. That's another evidence of sin. And we can be very happy often in sheer isolation. That's evidence of sin. Without the sex drive, why would men get married? I don't mean that casually. Now, obviously, there are other goods in marriage, and we must look to those as inseparable from all the other goods of marriage, like sex. Nonetheless, what awakens a young man's passion for marriage? It is, at least in a large part, for most men, I believe, if they're honest, the sex drive. That is the desire for genital fulfillment. God has given you this passion. God has given you this drive. What is it there for? It's saying, find thee a wife and keep yourself holy unto her. That's a counterintuitive, countercultural message. By definition, sex within marriage is not merely the accomplishment of sexual fulfillment on the part of two individuals who happen to share the same bed. Rather, it is the mutual self-giving that reaches pleasures, both physical and spiritual. The emotional aspect of sex cannot be divorced from the physical dimension of the sex act. Though men are more tempted to forget this, women possess more and less gentle measures of making the need clear. Consider the fact that a woman has every right to expect that her husband will earn access to the marriage bed. As the Apostle Paul states, the husband and wife no longer own their own bodies, but each now belongs to the other. At the same time, Paul instructed men to love their wives even as Christ has loved the church. Even as wives are committed and commanded to submit to the authority of their husbands, the husband is called to a far higher standard of Christ-like love and devotion toward the wife. Therefore, when I say that a husband must earn regularly his privileged access to the marital bed, I mean that a husband owes his wife the confidence, affection, and emotional support that would lead her to freely give herself to her husband in the act of sex. God's gift of sexuality is inherently designed to pull us out of ourselves and towards our spouse. Guys, towards a wife, our wife. For men, this means that marriage calls us out of our self-focused concern for genital pleasure and toward the totality of the sex act within the marital relationship. The requirements for the achievement of male sexual passion and satisfaction are minimal. By contrast, the level of intimacy required for female sexual fulfillment and emotional satisfaction are far higher. Put most bluntly, I believe that God means for a man to be civilized, directed, and stimulated towards marital faithfulness by the fact that his wife will freely give herself to him sexually only when he presents himself as worthy of her attention and desire. Perhaps specificity will help illustrate this point. I'm confident that God's glory is seen in the fact that a married man, faithful to his wife, who loves her genuinely, will wake up in the morning driven by ambition and passion in order to make his wife proud, confident, and assured in her devotion to her husband. Believe it or not, guys, your wife is not likely to see you first and foremost as a sex object. Tough news on a Saturday. When you awaken in the morning with hair unkempt, bad breath, a day's growth of beard on your face, and desperately in need of a shower, your wife is not likely to look at you and be filled with sexual passion to start your morning together in sexual union. A husband who looks forward to sex with his wife will aim his life toward those things that will bring rightful pride to her heart, will direct himself to her love as the foundation of their relationship, will present himself to her as a man in whom she can take both pride and satisfaction. Consider these two pictures. The first picture is of a man who has set himself toward a commitment to sexual purity and is living in sexual integrity with his wife. In order to fulfill his wife's rightful expectations and to maximize their mutual pleasure in the marriage bed, he is careful to live, to talk, to lead, and to love in such a way that his wife finds her fulfillment in giving herself to him in love. The sex act then becomes a fulfillment of their entire relationship, not an isolated physical act that is merely incidental to their love for each other. Neither uses sex as a means of manipulation. Neither is inordinately focused merely on self-centered personal pleasure, and both give themselves to each other in unapologetic and unhindered sexual passion. Now get that, unapologetic and unhindered sexual passion. That's where it is. In this picture, there is no shame. Before God, this man can be confident that he is fulfilling his responsibilities both as a male and, more importantly, as a man. He is directing his sexuality, his sex drive, and his physical embodiment toward the one flesh relationship that is the perfect paradigm of God's intention in creation. God, having created all things, declared all things to be good, and this is one of the shining goods of creation. The sex act in the marital union, in the unhindered giving of the one to the other, in the covenant of marriage. But by contrast, consider another man. This man lives alone, or at least in a context other than holy marriage. Directed inwardly rather than outwardly, his sex drive has become an engine for lust and self-gratification. Pornography is the essence of his sexual interest and arousal. Rather than taking satisfaction in his wife, He looks at dirty pictures in order to be rewarded with sexual arousal that comes without responsibility, without expectation, without demand. Arrayed before him are a seemingly endless variety of naked women, sexual images of explicit carnality, and a cornucopia of perversions intended to seduce the imagination and to corrupt the soul. This man need not be concerned with his physical appearance, his personal hygiene, or his moral character in the eyes of a wife. Without this structure and accountability, he is free to take his sexual pleasure without regard for his unshaved face, his slothfulness, his halitosis, his body odor, and his personal physical appearance. He faces no requirement of personal respect. No eyes gaze upon him in order to evaluate the seriousness and the worthiness of his sexual desire. Instead, his eyes roam across the images of unblinking faces, leering at women who make no demands upon him, who never speak back, and who can never say no. There is no exchange of respect, there is no exchange of love, and nothing more than the using of women as sex objects for his individual and inverted sexual pleasure. By logical consequence, he achieves sexual gratification at the expense of women who have been used and abused as commodified sex objects. He may imagine a sex act as he fulfills his physical pleasure, but he almost certainly does not imagine what it would mean to be responsible for this woman as husband and accountable to her as mate. He can sit in his soiled underwear, belching the remnants of last night's pizza, and engage in a pattern of one-handed sexual satisfaction while he surfs the net and forfeits his soul. These two pictures of male sexuality are deliberately intended to drive home the very point that every man must decide who he will be, whom he will serve, and how he will love. In the end, a man's decision about pornography is a decision about his soul, a decision about his marriage, a decision about his wife, and a decision about God. Pornography is a slander against the goodness of God's creation and a corruption of this good gift that God has given his creatures out of his own self-giving love. To abuse this gift is to weaken not only the institution of marriage, but the fabric of civilization itself. To choose lust over love is to debase humanity and to worship the false god Priapus in the most brazen form of modern idolatry. Just in case any of you have missed the point, let me conclude by making this issue perfectly clear. If you have been given the gift of celibacy, God intends you never to look upon a woman with sexual pleasure and sexual passion. The very essence of this gift is a freedom from lust and a freedom from sexual sin. It is, we must all admit, a rare gift. Guys, if you have not been given the gift of celibacy, then mark this truth, write it down, and engrave it on your hearts. God intends for you to see one and only one woman naked. I realize how radical that statement is. Just imagine people passing by out here on Lexington Road, hearing that God intends for a man to know only one woman's body, to know only one woman's breasts, to see only one vagina. I speak directly because it is so difficult for people to understand. That's what people are looking at pictures to see. That's what men are drawn to pornography to observe. Looking at thousands of pictures is to embed thousands of illicit images, thousands of images of illicit knowledge in the heart and in the soul. Let's be honest about what pornography is. You should approach your wedding night as the great unwrapping of a package, both mysterious and precious. You are to arrive at your marriage bed with no pictures in your mind that instruct you sexually or stimulate you carnally. The picture of moral purity is of a man who knows only one woman until they are separated by death and receives her as both covenant partner, complement, and also as lover. In reality, few men are likely to arrive at the marriage bed in such a state of moral innocence. Surrounded by a festival of erotic images and opportunities for lust, almost all men will bring illicit and ill-gotten images to the marital relationship. I'm speaking here not only of the intentional use of commercial pornography, but of the realities of living in postmodern America amidst such sexual explicitness and lasciviousness. This means that every man, young and old, must struggle against the tenor of the times and the temptations of the age. By God's grace, we must aim ourselves toward purity and claim the grace and power of Christ as our protection and only assurance. The deliberate use of pornography is nothing less than the willful invitation of illicit lovers and objectified sex objects and forbidden knowledge into a man's heart, mind, and soul. The damage to the man's heart is beyond measure, and the cost in human misery will be made known and clear only on the day of judgment. From the moment a boy reaches puberty until the day he is lowered into the ground, every man will struggle with lust. Let us follow the biblical example and scriptural command that we make a covenant with our eyes lest we sin. In this society, we are called to nothing less than to be a core of the mutually accountable amidst a world that lives as if it will never be called to account. I did something a little unusual in this. I have a manuscript, and I did so because of what I judged to be the importance of the issue I would address. This manuscript will be available to you on Southern Seminary's intranet by Monday afternoon. It's not going to be on the public internet at this point, but it'll be on the intranet. And if you'd like a copy, you'll be able to download it, I hope, by about noon on Monday. But that's where we are. And that's what I prepared to say. And I'm prepared to engage in conversation at this point. Jonathan, can you direct us as to how best to do that?
Questions are to right. My hand while we'll collect and then I'll hand those to you.
While we're collecting the sticky questions on sticky paper.
If you have one, give me if you don't.
I'll do my best to deal with what you got. Anyone want to raise an issue? Yes.
Yes, I'd love to know practically in your marriage how you fight against the temptation of the lust of the world.
Yeah. I think I'm able to answer this after 20 plus years of marriage in a way I wouldn't have known to answer it as a newlywed. You know, if you're really in a Christian marriage before God, your wife gets to know you better than you know yourself. And one of the issues that has to take place in marriage is real transparency and honesty. And guys, I just want to encourage you, at the earliest point in your marriage, let your wife know what you're really about. All right? Now, don't assume that women know this. Please, don't assume this. They're not made exactly as we are. So that means that early in your marriage, you need to be real honest and say, sweetheart, this is the way I'm wired. Part of it's God's design and part of it's undoubtedly sin. But I need to be accountable to you for this. And, you know, I would say that honesty is the main thing. And then you're accountable to each other, you know, and no longer does one person have a problem, the marriage has a reality to deal with. And I'm not going to say it's easy. I am going to say that it's godly. You know, it works. And, you know, there are, you know, for instance, my wife is not going to, when the Victoria's Secret catalog comes in the mail, my wife's not going to put it on my desk. If there's a catalog on my desk, it's not going to be pornographic and it's going to have something circled, which means hint, hint, hint. That's a different thing altogether. But I mean, that's an important thing. And I mean, my wife has full access to my computer, whatever. And I think that's just very important. When I travel, I'm talking to her all the time. And when I travel, by the way, I've got, you know, absolute principles of accountability as to who I'm with and where I am. And so there's structures of accountability. But still, let's face it, you can have a pornographic experience driving down Shelbyville Road. Or for that matter, going to church, given the immodesty of so many women who seem not to get it. So it is a continual struggle, and I find the healthiest thing is to talk about it, and talk about it with your wife. Mary's just finished this project on modesty. In fact, the booklets were just returned from the printer yesterday. And a part of that is coming out of our continual conversation in 20 years of marriage. I'm real honest to say, I just saw something over there. You know, tell me. And so she instantly writes down, that's out. So, you know, am I being clear? I don't mean to be flippant here. I want to be very sincere. In other words, a lot of it's just the sharing with your wife of the burden. You know, men are genitally driven. Our sexual passions are pretty easy to understand. Most of us are fairly uncomplicated. With the wife, it's a lot more complicated. And sometimes you just have to be real clear and say, in order to deal with this, I need your help in this way. And and then, by the way, you need structural supports, too, just to answer that. I mean, from the filters and everything else. For one thing, you need the filter just to do your very best to make sure that the stuff you're not even looking for doesn't pop up on your screen. All right. Wow. I'll deal with as many as I can, and if there are more, just send them up. As a single Christian, sometimes I feel uncomfortable teaching teens about sex. How should I handle this? Well, let me just give a critical principle that is implied in this. I think that the most important teaching about sex needs to come from someone who's having it. Don't mean to be crude, but legitimately, a married person. I think a married man should deal mostly with boys, and a married woman dealing mostly with girls. And that is because there's a certain credibility, obviously, that comes in speaking from that perspective. However, when you're dealing with youth, you don't get to choose the questions you get asked. And you don't get to choose the issues you're going to have to address. And if you're doing what I hope you're doing in verse-by-verse study through the Bible, you're going to come across those things. Now, by the way, while I'm on difficult terrain here and on the radio program on Wednesday, I had a woman who called, and I think she was from Iowa. And she was in high humbug because I was dealing with the issue of male leadership in the church. It was Ask Anything Wednesday. That's the question that came up. And I made the statement that I believe that when a boy reaches puberty, he ought to be primarily taught by men. In order, especially in the church, to make clear that this is a masculine faith. You know, the feminization of the church is a real problem. Well, oh, she went into high humbug and she wrote and all that. So here, while I'm in an equal opportunity offending mode, let me just also say that I do not believe in fulfillment of 1 Timothy 3 that a single man should be a pastor. Now, I can't give you a proof text that states it just that way. I can tell you that I can't imagine being a pastor without having a wife. Now, I was, truth in advertising here, I was a pastor of a church here in Kentucky for a year before I was married. I was engaged that entire time and just waiting for my wife to graduate from college. But even then, I felt awkward in some sense about it. And that's why, having been on both sides of it, I can just tell you that my pastoral ministry changed the day I was married. It changed in some really awesome ways. I could have conversations I couldn't have before. And I could feel free to sit down with the two of us, that is my wife and I, with a woman who needed to talk, where I didn't feel free to have that conversation at all before. And then sometimes she would have the conversation alone with the woman. So it's a matter of protection, and I'm not saying that a single youth minister or youth leader should never talk about sex. Please do not hear me to say that. You're not going to get to choose the terrain. But I am saying, acknowledge the fact that you're single, and if you're single dealing with teenage boys, then just be real clear, in a real, very real sense, I'm still right where you are as still being unmarried. And so we're in this together. Let's remember what's called for here and what's demanded of us. But I would regularly make certain that you're bringing in married men with holy marriages to deal with these issues. By the way, the very first day I had my wife with me as pastor, we returned from the honeymoon, I found out glaringly why you need your wife. In my absence, a dear lady in the church, this demure little sweet lady, about 30 years old, with her husband and three little boys, she fell and broke her collarbone. Having a background in the human body and in the names of bones, some demon led me to believe that I should name the bone, and I don't know what was going on here, but she came through and she was, marrying. For the first time in my marriage, my pastorate, Mary standing there beside me. I'd preached, and it was a great day, and Anyway, this dear little lady came through, and I said, Lana, I'm so sorry to hear that while we were gone, you fractured your cervix. Now, I meant clavicle, but it didn't come out that way. And I don't know if I was thinking cervical vertebra or what, but anyway, she just kind of looked at me and went, and just went on. And so after this, I'm still riding pretty high. You know, after you preach and everything's gone pretty well, you feel like, you know, this is a good day. Sun's out. God's, let's go have lunch. Sat down in the car, put her in, you know, opened the door for her. She sat down, little cold. And she got in and I went around and she looked at me. She said, why did you say that? I said, what did I say? What? She said, number one, you can't fracture a cervix. Number two, if you did, you would not want your pastor talking to you about it at the back door of the church. Are we clear on this? And I said, oh, yes. Woo. You know. Get thee a wife. I have had 11 to 12-year-olds in our youth group ask about oral sex being sex. How far should we go when teaching our teens or preteens? I find this probably the most frightening aspect of the sexualization of youth in this day. Is oral sex sex? Are we clear that it is? You know, the principles embedded here, you're not supposed to see anyone's genitals until you're married. And that's true for both girls and boys, obviously. You know, I can't think of anything more perverse as a spirit of delusion in a generation than being reassured or rationalized that this isn't sex. So how early? This is where I've had to make a change in my assessment of this over the last 10 years. I would like to think that you wouldn't have to talk about anything like this until college. And there once was a time, and that was probably true. I think of the guys I went to college with, I can just tell you, this never came up in conversation. It wasn't on the horizon of imagination. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you the truth, I basically thought that homosexuals did this. But given the fact that God's given males and females a very clear physical direction, I couldn't imagine why this would come up. And yet it has now. So the change I make is that I would be very clear in ministry, in dealing with parents on this, first of all, and stressing that the basic responsibility for preparing children for adulthood and preparing children to face sex is the parents. But a lot of what we're doing in ministry is a rescue operation. And so I would at least in every church make it optional for parents to bring their children for a very clear presentation of what's going on in sex, the biblical model, and clear do's and don'ts of expectation and accountability. Let me tell you, this isn't in the question, but I'll tell you, it's one of the main things I face around. What do you do with the fact that you have so many boys being raised by moms without dads? You know, there's a lot of things she can't possibly. She has the responsibility as parent, the only parent that's there, because some man, in all likelihood, in most cases, has abandoned his responsibility and left. Not in all cases, but in most cases. Now, someone's got to minister to that boy. I think every church ought to have a man-making ministry. I don't know what you're going to call it, but it needs to be where the church takes intentionality to deal with young men on these issues and to give assistance to mothers who really often can't deal with it. But to answer this directly, how far should we go when teaching our teens or preteens? If you don't talk about oral sex, you're not talking about what they're talking about. We've got to learn the art of speaking directly without speaking lasciviously. And here again, I would test to see where these kids are. And I would, here's my main teaching methodology on these things. It's Socratic. Make them ask the question. And that doesn't always work, but it'll get you a long way. Should we as a school, group, and or church boycott companies that support pornography, i.e. AOL's 48% of their spending on pornographic websites? Well, number one, I have mixed feelings about boycotts, I'll just be honest, because they are so difficult to maintain with moral clarity. But I'm not saying I never endorse one. I mean, if I was in California, I wouldn't go to Carl's Jr. simply because they're using Hugh Hefner unapologetically as a spokesman. But that's easy for me to say, number one, because I don't live in California. Number two, if I were in California, I'd have very little desire to go to Carl's Jr. anyway. But in all honesty, the other problem with boycotts is that the economy, if you understand the economy, it's so interwoven, it's really impossible to think that you're not. And for instance, I had someone in a local church here in Louisville try to start a boycott of a major corporation because they had involvement in selling alcohol. Now, I certainly wish they did not. I think they're fully accountable for the harm that comes by their sales. But I just asked this person, I said, where do you buy groceries? She said, well, Kroger. I said, well, Kroger sells alcohol. And she said, yeah, but you got to buy groceries. Well, you got to buy a wrench, too, you know, at some point. So discernment and Christian maturity is really called for here. You know, I on my program have called for a boycott of Abercrombie & Fitch. Because that's a company that explicitly has used pornography as a marketing tool. And you can buy clothes 1,000 different places. There's no particular need that Abercrombie & Fitch is meeting that someone else isn't meeting. And they're also fairly easy to target because in their corporate structure, they are what they are. And, you know, it's not like they're embedded in selling gas at the gas station or anything else. But these big companies, and with AOL, I'll admit, I don't know any way, or I don't know, the Internet being what the Internet is, find the safest, most accountable way you can get on the Internet and get off the Internet. And have your eyes protected while you're on the Internet, but it is never 100% safe. The Internet is like an ocean. No matter where you jump into it, you're still in the same ocean. And, you know, we need to be good stewards of every decision we make, every dollar we spend, and I don't want to give a confusing answer here. It's just that, you know, you have to take it boycott by boycott and see if it's really going to make any difference and if you can really do it honestly, because hypocrisy is a sin, too. You know, to boycott this grocery store for selling beer and then to go to the other one that sells beer, what in the world have you accomplished but to confuse people? Does there come a point when you're having too much sex in marriage? Yes. When you can't pay the bills. That's basically it. You know? When the bill collector gets you out of bed, then you're having too much sex in marriage. In all honesty, this is not going to be a problem. It's not, because somebody's going to have to get up and cook lunch. And somebody's going to have to go to work, and somebody's going to have to do these things. Guys, it's a great question. It's actually a sweet question. And the fact is, no. There's no one who's going to, you know, it's not like God's going, you're going to wear yourselves out. You know, there's none of this. No, God gave it to you. You know, gosh, go for it. And that's what I meant by the unapologetic and unabashed pleasure. That's it. But, you know, eventually somebody's going to have to go to work and somebody's going to have to shave and somebody's going to have to, you know, take care of the kids. Okay? And you're going to discover that the governor, you know, the governor on your sexual lives is often going to come with a cry and a diaper. And God's glory is in that, too. God's glory is in that big time. All right. Wow. When should a person be taught the reality of their inherent sex drive, specifically at what age? Puberty. And early in puberty. Because if you're told before then, I mean, you do need to know some basic, you know, I would talk to a 9 or 10 year old just to be clear about some birds and bees matters. Very rudimentary. I don't think Christopher would mind me mentioning that when he was about 8 or 9 years old, you know, because there's still a lot of things we hadn't talked about. But when he was about 8 or 9 years old, we were out watching the boats go by on the Ohio River. And I said, Christopher, have you ever wondered about where babies come from? He looked at me and he said, no, sir. That was the end of that conversation. I mean, that was pretty much it. You know? And then not too long after that, he was in a science class and they were talking about reproduction and they had sperms and eggs in plants. And I'll never forget this. He came and looked at me and he said, this is just plants, right? And I said, no, it's human beings too. And he said, what? And I said, yes. And I gave him the most basic presentation of mom and dad, sperm and egg, baby. Then he looks at me and he says, if two aircraft carriers were coming into the same harbor and one's older than the other, does it get to go in first? Which is his way of saying, got enough, don't need any more. Okay? One of my best friends who's a pastor in Washington had his son. They're riding along, and he decided to have the talk at about 10 just to kind of see where things are. And his son later looked at him and said, Dad, I'm just 10. Remember, I'm just 10. I mean, that's awesome, you know. And what you need is a relationship as a father with a son in which you don't have to have these big talks in isolation from what you're talking about in everyday life. But let me tell you, any boy who at 12 doesn't know that something is or is about to happen in him that's going to get his attention isn't being adequately parented and fathered in this way. You know, because that thing's about to fire up. And you don't want him going, well, good grief, what's this all about? You know, I saw this quite literally. I was 13. My best friend was 13. He lived next door. He did not have a dad. I did. He had a wet dream. And he missed a day of school because he thought he was dying. And he couldn't even tell his mom what was wrong. I'm really sick, really sick. What's wrong with you, son? I don't know, I was really sick. No one had ever told him about anything like this. So I was worried about why he missed a day of school. What's going on? I think I'm dying. And eventually it came down to, you know, figuring this out. And, you know, let me just tell you, one 12-year-old, 13-year-old to another is not a great sex educational experience. You know? But, I mean, I can just say from even then, I realized, you know, this, my dear friend, you know, he's lost as a pup in this. And, you know, a father ought to make sure his son does not have this kind of concern. What's he going to do when all of a sudden sexual arousal happens? What's going to happen when he has a nocturnal emission? When he all of a sudden walks around and, you know, 20% of his time, he's sexually aroused, including when he's asleep. Now, how's he going to deal with this? Yeah, I would say, you know, certainly at the age of puberty, and certainly if you're dealing with your own son, you're going to know, you know, about when that starts, and you're going to be able to talk to him, tracking him along the whole time. You know, too much information is a real risk. But it's less of a risk now than in any previous generation. And just make sure you are the primary sexual educator of your own children. But as a youth minister, perhaps that's a person that's a background to this too. You know, here again, track with the parents. Track with the parents. One youth minister I know had a mother come to him and complain and said, "You know, my son's not dealing with this. He's 14. My son's not dealing with this. None of this stuff you talked about." And this youth minister said, "You know, you seen him without a shirt on? Yeah. Does he have any hair under his arms? Yeah." He's dealing with it. Okay? Yeah, mom's the last to know. Usually. What's the best answer for the non-Christian who asks, why protect marriage? Even if I don't believe in God and the Bible, am I reduced to a better morality argument? Yeah, well, yeah. And this comes down to the basic conflict of the Christian worldview with every other worldview. Our worldview begins and ends with the glory of God and is structured by God's revelation to us in Scripture. So our worldview can never get out of that. That's the frame we're in, and that's our reality. Now, the person that doesn't share that reality, well, I mean, this is in the Bible. I mean, it's not like the Bible didn't know this was going to happen. There's a way that seems right unto man. It's a way that leads to destruction. Narrow is the way that leads to salvation. Wide is the way that leads to destruction. The unregenerate man and the regenerate man think in fundamentally different terms. So how do you argue for marriage to the unregenerate man? Well, number one, make clear that you're making a regenerate argument. Well, arguments aren't regenerate. You're making an argument from a regenerated mind, a point of view, and say, well, I'm able to speak to you because of the Creator's intention in marriage, but even if you don't accept that, there's still an obligation to protect marriage for the very protection of civilization. And so when you ask here, you know, a better morality argument, You know, that's why when I debated at the Louisville Forum and the national media on this issue, I point to the awful effect of destroying marriage. But I also always feel absolutely accountable to make clear, in the end, my argument is rooted in the Holy Scripture. I'm a Christian theologian. I'm not a sociologist. I'm not an anthropologist. But it shouldn't take... You know, here's the point. It shouldn't take a Christian theologian to figure out that marriage is to be protected. It's the Christian who knows why. And that's the problem. We're in a Romans 1 situation here, but we've been there for a long time. Has society's divorce of sex from procreation via birth control contributed to its divorce of sex from marriage, pornography, and immorality? And how should the church respond to this separation? Absolutely. And if you've had any of my classes in Christian worldview or anything else, you know this is one of the major themes I strike. Evangelicals haven't thought through the birth control issue and have bought into the contraceptive mentality. The French doctor who developed the main oral contraceptive was celebrated last year on the 50th anniversary of the development of the pill for having liberated sex from marriage. That is what the French government said in the citation they presented to him. Liberated human beings from the repressive bonds of marriage and procreation, etc. Now, I'm not arguing that a Christian couple can never use any mechanism of birth control that's non-abortive fashioned. That is, it doesn't run the risk of an abortion. And there's too little time to trace this through, but I have this on tape and in writing if you want it. I think there's considerable risk in using at least many, if not most, oral contraceptives in terms of a possible abortive fashion effect. And so my default position is to advise against using oral contraceptives. But again, I don't want to be duplicitous. I do not have a proof text I can lay before a couple. I just want to deal with what I consider to be the arguments for and against, with the concern for life and the indissolvability of the goods of marriage as the concern. But the default position for a Christian couple should be sex for children. Now, again, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I'm not saying that every couple has to maximize the possible number of children they could have. If you get married at 23, and you and your wife, and you're both healthy, you're going to have 15 children by the time you're 40, on average. I mean, that's just a statistical average. A child every 17 to 19 months. Well, obviously, there are very few people who are either having sex or not using some form of birth control. I find the Roman Catholic position to be unsustainable because it finds the most significant meaning in the sperm and in the egg. When I think from a biblical perspective, the most basic meaning is in the act rather than in the exchange of fluids and cells. So, you know, my answer to this question is yes. The contraceptive mentality has horribly done this because it's taken away the cause and effect relationship. And this is one of the most important things. I just taught a group of Christian men about fathering, and I dealt with the punishment issue, corporal punishment. I said, you have to realize why that's so important according to the Scripture. It's not just that there's some means. It's not just that it's something that works. It's not to be done in anger. It is to demonstrate in this child's life cause and effect. As you sow, so shall you reap. We are not born bent to discipline our lives according to cause and effect. That's why right then, right there, dad has to be judge, jury, and executioner to say, you did this, now this has to happen. Not because I'm in a bad mood. Not because you just ticked me off. Not because I just feel that way this day and consistently from any other day. But there is cause and effect. You do this, this happens. That's the way the court system is supposed to work. On the Larry King show, I've debated the death penalty issue I don't know how many times. But the death penalty is messed up in this country primarily because it's no longer tied to cause and effect. In the Scripture, the Genesis 9 perspective on, and Romans 13, I would argue, perspective on capital punishment is, it's cause and effect. You kill one made who is in the image of God. You murder, and particularly, one who's made in the image of God. You forfeit your own life. Cause and effect. Well, the way we treat the death penalty today, you know, people are now executed so far from the crime, so far from any knowledge of it, and it's disconnected from the crime such that we lose the moral meaning. And so my method, my suggestion is don't abolish the death penalty, fix it. But when it comes to cause and effect on sex, pregnancy was a part of God's reminder that there is an effect. And so to separate pregnancy and procreation from the act of sex liberated. It's the same way that if there is no parental discipline, the child's going to go his own way. And if there's no law, the citizens are going to go their own way. If there's no cause and effect in any area of life. I mean, if people could get away with cheating on their taxes, no one would pay any taxes. And we have to start from the default position, like I talked about in my address, of understanding that we start from an understanding of human sin and sinfulness. So how do we recover? Well, I don't know. I think it's number one, in terms of cultural recovery, I don't have great hope. But recovery in the church, I think it means that Christian couples need to be right up front with each other. And by the way, this means that unmarried people, as Christians, unmarried Christians, don't need any birth control. Are we clear on that? And once you do have married couples, they need to use such things with trembling and with fear before God to bring God the greatest glory. And I do believe that parents can help, Christian parents can help to space their children and do other things, but they can't ultimately divorce sex from children. Every time a husband and wife enter into one flesh relationship, there should be the joy in the fact that God has designed this not only for personal pleasure, but for also the giving of children and all the rest. Okay, I have no idea what time it is. What can you do sexually after marriage and what not to do? Oh, we're out of time. Oh, good grief. I'm not going to give you a catalog. Basically, I believe a husband and a wife are freed to enjoy each other physically, sexually, and relationally in any way that does not violate God's word, rob God of his glory, bring indignity to either partner, nor shame to the marriage, nor bring in anything illicit. That's the best I know. And so I would say that going outside of Scripture and in terms of some elaborate reasoning to try to figure out a codified list and not list is going to be problematic. But that said, the very premise of my address and understanding of sex is that complementarity is calling us to the one flesh relationship, which means sexual intercourse. And we're clear on what that is. That's what our bodies very clearly testify we are made for. Within the marriage relationship, I don't think Christian couples should interrogate each other on how you get there or whatever, so long as they're no sinful, illicit, denigrating, wrongful things that are brought into that. But in terms of what a husband and wife can do with each other, before God, they are to enjoy each other, they are to give themselves to each other, and they are to receive all the good gifts of God in sex and in marriage as a whole and not just as isolated parts. God bless you.